Have you heard about the new MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle? The MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle is the easiest, most advanced nozzle ever, protecting you from the dangers of diesel exhaust fumes. With its patented flex magnet technology, the Pro Nozzle easily attaches with one hand from a standing position, can snap on from any angle, and fits flush to the apparatus, saving a ton of space. A MagnaGrip is the only exhaust removal system that offers a true 100% seal. For free grant assistance and to learn more, go to MagnaGrip.com.
This fire engineering podcast is made possible by Tenkata Protective Fabrics. The global leader in flame-resistant fabrics, Tenkata Protective Fabrics enables millions of people worldwide to be great at what they do. Generations of industry professionals serving in the fire service, industrial, and military industries rely on Tenkata fabrics for safety, comfort, and confidence. From the harshest working conditions to the welcoming site of home, Tenkata recognizes the people they're protecting are unique individuals whose lives extend beyond work. Supporting a world of evolving needs, Tenkata's innovations lead the way in user-centric design, technology, and sustainability around the globe. To learn more, please visit TenkataFabrics.com.
Okay, so welcome to another edition of 1st 2 Battalion Chief Black Sweep Radio with Danny Sheridan. Today with me, I have Chuck Montgomery from the Hall of Flame, the museum in Phoenix. So, Chuck, I'm going to let you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about the museum, and then we'll get started. Yeah.
Thank you, Danny. I appreciate that. I spent a career as a firefighter, paramedic, and later captain, and worked through the ranks and left my department as the deputy fire chief of the Glendale Fire Department. Glendale, Arizona is a large metropolitan department here in the Phoenix metro area. It has automatic aid agreements with Phoenix Fire Department. So it tends to be the west side of the valley, as we called the Valley Metro. Our total area is about, for the entire Phoenix area, is about 6 million people that we serve. And we do that with 29 different municipalities, all of them coming together in one large system called the Automatic Aid System in Phoenix. Glendale was the first department in that Automatic Aid with the city of Phoenix, and then others have come since then. Busy department, 9 stations, ran about 40,000 responses annually. We also covered the Super Bowl stadium is in our area, Cardinals football stadium, Coyotes hockey arena, that sort of thing. Great department, all ALS fire engines and ladder companies, 2 EMTs and 2 paramedics per truck. Stayed in the fire service for 37 years. In that capacity and various ranks, and then came over upon retirement about 8 months later. I was called into a meeting with the family that owns the Hall of Flame, and they asked if I'd be interested in remodeling and taking over the Hall of Flame. So I accepted that position and went to work. Started here on site at January 1 of 2020. The museum just celebrated its 60th anniversary. And we're proud to represent the fire service. I'm the first firefighter to ever run the museum, and I think we've managed to increase our attendance by fourfold. So we're up to a 400% increase since I started back in 2000. We completed our Rescue 4 project, which was rehabilitating Rescue 4 and bringing it back to a state very much like it was on September 10th before it responded to the World Trade Center. And when you see it and or see it online, you'll it reflects that.
Okay, Chuck. Well, anyway, just to give you a little history of how I got connected with you, I was on a boat ride in New York City with the radio station that we listened to called WFUV. And I ran into one of the disc jockeys, and he just grabs me and says, "Hey, Danny, you know, are you still on the fire department?" And I said, "Yeah, of course. Where else would I be, you know?" And he says, "I want you to help get the word out for the Hall of Flame, this museum." And then he hooked me up on Instagram. And so I said, "Sure, Corny." His name is Corny O'Connell anyway. And I said, "Absolutely, whatever you need." And I just, I guess I tagged you guys, or friended you guys, and I've been, you know, been following your stuff now. So, and then I got to, I guess I sent you guys a email or something, and we got connected. And because I think what the impetus, the crux of it was that I was looking to, I have some stuff, like some paraphernalia, gear, whatever you want to call it, memorabilia is a better word, that I was like looking to see if maybe get out of my basement and see if it, you guys would be interested in it. Like my, let's say my old helmet, coat and boots from the 80s, or I have every WNYF article magazine ever written, I think, except for maybe a few, I think over the years. I had gotten them from my father-in-law. He had gotten them since the magazine started in 1940, I would say. So I have, this is 2020, so I probably have about 80 years worth of WNYF. And then I have all this other assorted, fire, FDNY. And also, I have a lot of memorabilia from Latin America. And you were telling a story about something about the Buffs. And when you were saying, when you're telling me the story about how the Buffs started with the Buffalo Coats in New York City, 1865, when they went to the pay department, it sounds a lot like what's going on in Ecuador and Guayaquil. Very, very similar, because when I first started with those guys 20 years ago, it was the volunteers that were the ones that were the, held in high regard, and the paid guys, not so much. And that's kind of evolving right now. Very similar. Mm-hmm. 150 years later to New York City, what we went through back in the 1860s, so.
It was even, I'm sure you know this history, but even to the point where when the volunteers were asked to vacate the stations, they were asked to take their items with them. And they did in most part, but a lot of the things they left behind, the rigs and the equipment, a lot of that was distributed across the United States. They came up with they sent out a memo and communication through various sources and offered up large shipments of fire equipment to different places in the United States. And I know one of those departments was in the process of receiving a shipment, and the ship sank in a hurricane on its way down to, I believe it was either North or South Carolina, and they lost the entire shipment of all of this stuff. And I know New York then came back later and assisted this department with that completed shipment that had been lost at sea. And when you guys had 9/11, that same department then provided you a ladder truck that they had on order, and you took delivery of that truck, and it was a pretty well-known incident for quite a while. So it was that 1865 is an interesting time to read about the FDNY.
Yeah, I think I'm not too sure, but 1865, that's around the same time as the Civil War. And I know there was the draft riots in New York City, and I know there was a big fire in New York City around that time in the 1860s, So, yeah, you're right. That was a very, kind of a banner year. Ironically enough, I think that year, 1865, one of my ancestors came to America from Ireland. I think it was 1865 on my father's side. My great-great-grandfather and my great-great-grandmother came over from Ireland in 1865 into New York. So, yeah, kind of a banner year. So, anyway, you spoke about the rigs. I can tell you on 9/11, I can't imagine how many rigs we lost, because I'm trying to think of how many companies were down there and how many rigs were actually involved in a collapse. But we lost quite a few rigs on 9/11. So
I had heard it was in the hundreds. I had heard in excess of 200.
Okay. Well, let's say in New York,
that could be staff vehicles and ambulances and police cars. So I don't know what number that represents. I just know that Rescue 4, what we ended up with here was quite heavily damaged. And for a while it was placed back in service as kind of one of the only road ready rigs after the incident. And it got, you know, as reserve rigs do, it got, took quite a beating. And so when it made it to the crushing place in Chicago, it was in pretty rough shape, and it was about to be destroyed. And of course, through a whole many sets of circumstances, it ended up here at the Hall of Flame through lots of transition and different ownerships and things. But I know our volunteers went right to work on it, and out of just admiration and respect for FDNY, they brought it back to incredible condition. And you've got to see that on the video, Danny, as you flew through it, right? You
get to see
what we brought it back to. And I have to say, we get lots of New York visitors here. And you know, we have a New York retirees chapter here in Phoenix, and they were very helpful in the process as well. John Ferry and other members of that organization.
Right. So coincidentally enough, this past weekend, I was teaching up at the New York State Fire Chiefs, and someone actually mentioned, and I wish I had wrote the name down. He said, oh, so-and-so from Rescue 4 is out in Arizona. And I said, boy, I wonder if he's involved with this Hall of Flame, you know?
Joe Tufano?
That was the guy.
Yeah, Joe Tufano. He's ironically, and very ironically, he lives up in northern Arizona, about 100 miles from the valley. And yes, I'm very well acquainted with him. For a short period of time, I had the pleasure of working with him in some of his later capacities after he retired from FDNY.
Right. So it's kind of a coincidence that Rescue 4 was in my old neighborhood. I grew up in Woodside in Queens, and they were up on Queens Boulevard, 64th Street, maybe around there somewhere, 65th Street, just a little bit west of it. And, you know, so I used to see them growing up. I used to see them all the time in the neighborhood, you know. Mm-hmm. So I had worked, when I came on the job, I started out in 17 Truck, which is in the South Bronx. And then I went over to the squad, which, you know, was in SOC. And, I wouldn't say a heck of a lot, but I did work in Rescue 4, especially when I was a lieutenant. I covered in SOC. So I covered there for a few years. So I worked in all the rescues and, you know, in the two squads at the time. And one of my good friends left Squad 41 to go to Rescue 4, and he was killed in a fire on October 8th, 1995. His name was Pete McLaughlin. And I didn't think I mentioned his name to you, and you weren't really aware of that, you know. So
I don't know. I do not know that that incident or his name, but we do know the two incidents associated with this particular apparatus was the Father's Day fire, which the anniversary yesterday. If you go to our Facebook or Instagram, you'll see some postings that we had in relation to that. And then of course, 9/11. So nine members on 9/11, and of course the members that were lost at the Father's Day fire. So their names are still painted on the front of the truck, and we talk about that in the narrative that's there with the truck. So sat two very, very tragic incidents related, and it's just ironic. I don't know if the gentleman you mentioned was on this vehicle, or was that on a previous apparatus?
See, I don't know. He died in 95. I know that on Father's Day, that was June, and Brian Fahey sat not next to me in probie school, but he sat two away from me. And Brian and I became very good friends in probie school. Actually, Brian gave me a leather helmet from his volley company in like Hempstead somewhere, you know. So I still have the helmet. It's down on my wall downstairs. I wore it for a few years. But and then I think there was another line of duty death from Rescue 4 back in, I want to say, in the early 90s. It was a lieutenant. He fell out a window on a second floor. I was working at night. It was, I think his name was Williams. And I can't believe I can't remember his name. So, you know, there was a lot of, I hate to say the word hard luck. That's what, you know, they sometimes, the term is used in the fire service. But Rescue 4 did have, even before 9/11, they had their, you know, they had the Father's Day, they had Pete, and then they had Williams, all within 10 years of each other, you know. And then obviously 9/11 was the ultimate, you know. So anyway, so yeah, so let's talk about first about the museum. So okay. Yeah, so Corny, you know, he had asked me to spread the word, you know, and I said, I'll do the best I can. And then we spoke, and then I mentioned that I have some stuff I'm still planning on. I don't know whether I'm going to deliver it in person or it's, or mail it, but you know, first I want to double check with you and see what you guys are interested in, because I would imagine that the WNYF magazines would be something that would be, I don't know, would be something of interest to your visitors. Do you have like a reading room there or like a video room, a media room?
We have an extensive library that's has collections of many things, of course, fire engineering, many, almost all the past episodes or editions of that, other just there's organizations, collector organizations that have years of publications with us. Yeah, we have an extensive library. It's pretty impressive, actually. And folks come here regularly to just set. It's not a checkout library. It's just a place where there's a large table and folks can just sit and do their own research. But it's quite a remarkable thing. The museum itself, we have well over 100, I'll say items on wheels, because not everything's a fire truck. In some cases, it's a fire wagon. In some cases, it's a hose cart. Right. So I'll just say that we have over 100 pieces on wheels, and the number actually is probably closer to 120. We have two large buildings. Each one's about the size of a Walmart.
Wow.
And, the museum can be obtained online by going to Hall of Flame, just one word, halloflame.org. Mm-hmm. We'll take you to our site. And if you scroll down a little bit, there's four videos there that introduce Rescue 4. There's another one that's a drone fly through of our entire main building. And then some other interviews that we've done. We also have an important piece here from the locally a tragedy that occurred called the Granite Mountain Hotshots.
Oh yeah.
And that was a fire up on Yarnell Hill, not far from the Phoenix metro, about an hour outside of town, and that killed 19 wildland firefighters. And so their truck is permanently placed here. We have a truck that a hand pumper, I should say, that fought the Great Chicago Fire from Centerville, Wisconsin, that was loaded on a train and taken down to Chicago for that. We have pieces, our very first piece is a Newsham fire truck that goes back to, or a fire pumper that goes back to 1725. So 51 years before we were a country. And it's pretty amazing. That piece has never been restored. It's in its original condition, which is very, very well cared for. And this place is worth seeing. There's a lot worth seeing in Arizona, and we're one of them. One of our guests at one point said there's two things that have to be seen when you're in Arizona: the Grand Canyon and the Hall of Flame. And and we said, really, the Hall of Flame after the Grand Canyon? So, right. But it's remarkable. We were voted by a local publication here the best museum in the valley for children. And I think in this time in our right now, it really is interesting to go back and look through American history and learn the things that can be learned here. Because, you know, when you go back to the early volunteer days back in the 16 and 1700s, I mean, it was really turbulent, and people don't quite realize that the fire hall in a community was really the main structure of politics, as it were, in that community. So, you know, everybody that was somebody wanted to be a part of it. and they were part of it. And that led to, you know, both good and bad. I mean, in the case of, you know, Tammany Hall in New York and Boss Tweed, you know, not such a great thing, right? He was quite notorious. He died in a New York City jail of pneumonia. And, but after years and years of some pretty extensive trouble, and the country was very divided by the fire companies that operated. They, you know, they had lots of different affiliations, and some of those affiliations, you know, it's been depicted in a couple of different things. But when you're here at the museum and you get to see the extent that they went to make their pieces stand out against the neighboring units, and then learning about some of the annex that went on to try and derail the neighboring units, you know, for the pleasure of the fire insurance companies, it's just interesting. And I find it, to me, even after 37 years, Danny, like you, you go, wow, there's, you know, you've seen a lot and heard a lot, but not always really knowing the full significance of it. And and I have to say now that that I get to actually dive into this stuff every day, it's really quite remarkable. And and I tell my wife, I go, what a great thing to have left the fire service and then get to learn something new every single day for the rest of my career here. Right. And while I'm trying to restore this history, and it is fascinating. Your city specifically, FDNY, has such a story to tell. It's such an amazing organization, as well as that, like I say, that deep transition. You had thousands and thousands of volunteers that were displaced, you know, in that movement. And that, you know, that even though it now, to tell somebody that was a difficult transition, I don't think they could really appreciate how difficult it was to make that movement. Otherwise, if it wasn't so difficult, you would have been the first department to go career, but you were not. It was the very first career department, as you know, is Cincinnati. And Cincinnati did it by firing essentially almost 1,800 volunteers in one evening after a very destructive fire hit their community, and not much fire was fought, but a lot of blood was shed. And the city finally said, that's enough. And that's really where the steamer came into play, because they could replace a 150 man, you know, hand pumping crew with a steam operating crew of three guys and some horses.
Right. So I had read that, you know, I love the history too of New York City. And I like reading about it. And I read that it was like a badge of honor when they could wash out the other rigs. So they had those hand pumpers, and, you know, they would try to pump harder than the company in front of them and make it the water wash out over the rig, you know. And, you know, we have in the fire department in New York City, we have, I'm trying to think of where they were at the Rock. We have probably a handful of old pumpers. I know there's one in the lobby, there's one in the new building. I had heard, and I think they had found, I don't know if this is a myth, but they were cleaning out some sanitation garage somewhere, I think it was in Queens, and there was behind the wall, there was all these fire trucks. I don't know if that was just urban myth or if that was true, but I know that I've been down to the Spring Street Museum, and there's a bunch of rigs down there, but it's a smaller building. You know, it's only an old firehouse, right? Right. I think it's three floors. And that old history is just amazing, you know.
And it just shows you the, you know, if you think about it in terms of the way, as, you know, what we take on as a nation, essentially, you know, not unlike what we've just experienced with COVID, you know, I think that nightly and quite often, far more than we really understand, that hundreds of people were dying in these large tenements, you know, with absolutely no way to get out. You know, you lost 146 women there at the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire. Yeah. You know, most of them all jumped to their death. And, you know, these massive catastrophes that were just taking place. And even within the fire department, I mean, they were just regularly, both in the volunteer era and later in the paid era, you know, they were just chalking up lots and lots of firefighter fatalities. And and serious injuries. And I think that's why another important part of our museum comes into play, which is the legacy of Dr. Archer, which is probably one of the most fascinating stories I've ever heard. And we do a remarkable job of presenting his story. You know, we have his three helmets here. If you Google Dr. Archer Hall of Flame, you'll see not only see those helmets, but then you'll see footage of him working at incidents and some of the heroism that he displayed in his years as a volunteer for the fire department. He was a physician and he was quite well off. His dad owned the Erie Railroad. He had no reason to want for anything. And his only desire was to help his friends in the fire service. He had spent a lot of time, I believe, in station, I think it was 56 was near his home. Would that make sense?
I'm trying to think. See, a lot of the engines in New York City have gone by the wayside, you know, like I could imagine they were numeric, you know, like one, yeah. But there's no two, there's a three, there's a four. So, you know, like a lot of them are gone. So I think there was a 56 engine at one point.
Yeah. Well, on his helmet, the helmet that we have that was given to him as a appreciation helmet, it's says 56 and has a red cross above it. And on the back brim, it was in recognition of his dedication to the department. And you just learn about this guy and you say, my gosh, 60 years, sheer volunteer, never missed a fire. And he kind of, I think he's really the person that started to kind of like round the corner in the 1800s as firemen were just being brought out of structures, not breathing on a pretty regular basis. His mission there on the sidewalks were to get those firefighters, get their airways opened and get them breathing once again. And I think he saved countless lives doing that. And then later that migrated on to oxygen delivery and later, you know, burn treatment. And then when needed, he would actually go in and try and cut free firemen that were trapped in the debris of a collapse or even sometimes citizens. So I have three helmets. One's a black helmet in recognition of him in spirit, an incredible fire advocate. And then later he has a white chief's helmet that he held a rank. It says medical officer on it. And then he has a helmet that looks a lot like a World War I, almost like a doughboy helmet, you know, the round, I'm not sure the official name of it, but it's like a civil defense helmet that he wore apparently. And that was what he was classically known as wearing on scenes. But I would highly encourage anyone that has, and I don't know nearly enough about Dr. Archer in comparison to the awards that are given every 3 years. And, you know, I know you have had to have received a Bennett to be qualified for an Archer. Is that correct, Chief?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that to me, that says a lot that he was really held in extremely high esteem. But how these helmets ended up here at the Hall of Flame, I would imagine they were part of a collection at one point that was obtained by my predecessors. And I don't think they really knew the full extent of how important they were. So have you seen that video by chance?
Of what? Of Dr. Harry Archer?
Dr. Archer is the one that we did on Archer as far as his, the pieces that we have here on display.
No, I haven't got a chance to look at that yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, this stuff. I was just wrapped up this last weekend up in the fire chiefs, the New York City Fire Chiefs conference, you know, so I was teaching up there. So,
okay.
You know what I love New York City. I have to tell you, I was born in the city and I lived there till I was about 30, 29. I moved up here to Putnam County, but I've been down there for 36 years working. So I started, I got the idea from a trip that I was on. We were over in Jerusalem and this fellow was doing like a city walking tour of Jerusalem, you know? So I had the idea. I said, boy, I'd love to do that in New York because I know the city pretty well. So we did one and then COVID hit you know, and guys are waiting for the next one. But, you know, what I wanted to do was to start somewhere like in Midtown, which we did, and then, you know, work our way all the way downtown and ultimately end up with the World Trade Center in that museum. And in part of doing that, I had to do a lot of research, you know, and it's amazing, you know, when you look back in the 20s and 30s and 40s, when, you know, we had all these collapses and, you know, in these loft buildings and whatnot, because that area down there, they call it the Hell's 100 Acres, right? And it's in Soho, south of Houston, and what we kind of call now Tribeca, Soho, where we have a lot of loft buildings, you know, so there's a lot of history down there. You know, you talked about the tenements and whatnot, and like one for instance was a 20 truck there on Lafayette Street, right by between Spring and Prince, and the captain there, his name was Kenlin, John Kenlin, and he ultimately became the commissioner of the FDNY, but his company was known as the Kenlin's Giants, right? And to be in that company, you had to be well over 6 foot. I don't know what the exact measure, you know, height was, but, you know, you hit the nail on the head, because back then on the Lower East Side, they had all these tenements, you know, and over the years, you know, the old law tenement, they probably started building them probably around the 1860s, you know, and they had wooden interior stairs and they had transoms over the windows. And, you know, they were just basically fire traps, you know, and these guys were dealing with this stuff. That's why there were so many companies down there. There were tons of engines and truck companies down there. And back in the day, all those companies were the busy companies, like 20 truck and 3 truck. They're on 13th Street. You would have 1 truck, which is our first towel ladder there on Duane. 8 truck, 11 truck. You know, the numbers are low, right? Because those are the original companies in the FDNY. And they were all, you know, they were very busy companies back in those days. You know, yes. My great-grandfather actually was a cop in the Lower East Side. He was a sergeant who created this thing called the Gangster Squad, you know, that was his claim to fame with the New York City Police Department. But I read his service record, and he was involved in a big fire on Canal Street, I think. It was numerous fatalities, explosion, and, you know, rescues, and he made a few rescues actually, you know, in this incident. But yeah, that was a normal occurrence, you know, and I tried to, you know, with this New York City walking tour, I try to go by the Triangle Shirtwaist, the Worcester Street collapse. You know, then we have the phone company, which is later on in the 70s. And of course, we have the, you know, the 23rd Street collapse in the 66. So, yeah, there's a lot of history. And you know, it's good that we remember this stuff, you know.
Well, and it's also interesting to me, Danny, how it has a ripple effect far beyond New York. So just as one small example, here in the museum, we have the very first, what would be considered SCBA, if you will, self-contained, certainly not pressurized by a bottle, but a self-contained breathing apparatus. And that inspiration to make that unit came out of the Triangle Factory fire that, you know, this gentleman was in Cleveland and he's working in the sewing industry, you know, trying to develop enhancements for sewing machines just for that very purpose, so they don't overheat and cause fires in the belts. So he's done things with that. He's kind of an ingenious inventor by nature. And, he actually develops this hood. After he hears, all he had to do is hear about it and read about that incident, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. And he, from that point forward, dedicated his life to finding ways that you could make it through the smoke, because almost every one of those women died ultimately because of smoke. None of them were ever exposed particularly to the flames of fire. It was a smoke incident. There was a fire, of course, but, you know, they jumped due to the not being able to breathe. And so this guy goes on, and his name's Garrett Augusta Morgan. And Mr. Morgan developed this self-contained breathing hood. And it became, you know, through lots of transition and gyration, it finally became accepted, you know, years after he invented it. And he dedicated the patent to the state of Ohio. But there again, born out of a New York tragedy, is the idea of breathing. And as you probably know, labor unions were formed because of that incident and the way that the owners had locked the girls inside. So two different things came together. Our ability to stay within a fire atmosphere longer because of Mr. Morgan's hood, but then also the, you know, something that heavily affects the fire service, which are, you know, is our labor unions. And those, you know, that came from the, you know, the women rising up and saying, never again, we're not going to be, you know, treated in this fashion and then die in droves. But Mr. Morgan, he had to actually prove his hood worked in a mine explosion in Cleveland to actually drive the point home of how effective this would be in a toxic environment. And he did so. And later on, that after he gifted that to the state of Ohio and basically gifted it to the fire service, American Fire Service, he then, a decade later, went on to invent the traffic light, the three-stage red, yellow, green traffic light. So if you want to Google an interesting name, it's Garrett Augusta Morgan. Garrett Morgan, born in Paris, Kentucky, 1877.
I wish I had your propensity to remember names, because I know out of that fire too, there was a elevator operator, and he was an Italian guy, and he saved numerous,
yes, he did.
Government workers. He went up and down, and yes, he did. Even the elevator was on fire, and he was still going up.
And I heard about that.
People out, and I can't remember his name. It's Louis. I wish I could remember these names. You know.
I can't wait to find it out, because then I'll add him to the exhibit as a heroic, you know, while you mention that, there, look at all of the civilian heroes that, you know, that performed the day of 9/11. I mean, there's countless folks that stepped in and did things far outside of their scope or their training,
right,
and saved lives along with the New York City Fire Department. So I think citizenry, I think people, you know, definitely step forward. Many people do in times of tragedy and do what needs to be done.
Yeah.
Thank God for those, their existence.
Don't ask me how I know this, but his name is Joseph Zito.
I'm writing it down right now.
Joseph Zito. Yes. He was an Italian guy, and he kept going back and forth with the elevator, and he saved numerous people. Just a regular civilian, you know.
Spell that last name for me.
Z-I-T-O.
Z-I-T-O.
Yeah, Joseph Zito. Man. You know, on the flip side, too, I mean, the tragedy of the doors being locked, you know, these poor people being locked in because they were afraid that they were stealing, whatever it was, you know.
Well, and also the girls, you know, they were taking, you know, a lot of these were young, you know, 14, 15-year-old girls, and they were, you know, they would take smoke breaks out on the, you know, outdoors, and there were a lot of reasons that they had, you know, that they had tried to justify locking them in the building, but obviously none of them held any water. It was just, you know, it was just a cruel employment practice of that era, you know, in any sweatshop, in any part of the country, in any part of the world that, you know, took advantage of the situation. So I'm sure that we're not, you and I both know from our jobs currently that we're not immune from those conditions even today.
Listen, there was a fire in I'm gonna say Paraguay, and it was within the last, I want to say 10 years, where what happened was a perfect storm. There was a grill, you know, they call it a perillo, and they had foam roofing, right? So over the course of time, all the fat and the grease caused it to ignite, and the owners of the supermarket were afraid that people would be stealing the groceries, so they locked all the doors. And I think like 300 people died in that fire because they were all locked in. So this is the 21st century, right?
Yeah.
This is happening, right? So you know, at least they say if we forget history, we're doomed to repeat it. And you're looking at all these places in other parts of the world, right? And same things are happening, right? Same so,
yeah, we just had the, you know, within our recent memory, we had the station fire, right? That was a You know, same thing, using a flammable material on the walls and then having all those folks trapped in that building for various reasons and covered exits and stuff like that. So, you know, and then not long after that, of course, came the ghost ship fire in Oakland. And same thing, they had stairwells made out of pallets and, you know, all these folks living in this art studio. So, you know, that was a very tragic fire out in Oakland. So it's, you're right, it's things continue, but if we don't, if we, and maybe that's the whole purpose of a, of teaching fire history. So we could try and keep people safe and remember that things occur because, you know, today's the way news kind of rattles off and so much comes at us, people just kind of forget history. I know I watch people come into our museum and we go into this, some of this stuff and it jogs their memory like, yeah, what, you know, now I do remember that. And then they start thinking back in detail and what changed because of that. And, you know, and of course there's always changes, but then no matter when, even if there's changes, you know, comes the whole avenue of enforcement, which is, you know, as you know, and I know there's never enough hours in a day or enough people to get out there and constantly do that type of work.
Yeah. So I'm fascinated though by this museum in Phoenix in Arizona on the other side of the country. Yeah. That has all these ties to New York City because, you know, I don't know. I just, it's kind of fascinates me because, you know, you expect maybe, you know, I wouldn't expect it. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't expect a museum like this in our state whatsoever. I mean, you know, and there's a lot of places that you would expect this. If it wasn't in New York, then your next thought is maybe it's in Baltimore or Chicago or, And I will tell you, this museum in its history started out in Lake Geneva. And the reason it was there is because the family that began, they were business folks in Chicago, and many people in Chicago go to Lake Geneva to vacation. So they had a second home there. And essentially the Mr. George Getz got a fire truck for Christmas. And within a couple of years, he had 19 of them collected and were restoring. And then he opened up a place and a friend of his said, wow, that's a lot of fire trucks. You get yourself a regular Hall of Flame. And so became the pun that became our title. And then I think over time, you know, it took many years because your Hudson Museum is quite extensive and beautiful. And it took many years for us to grow, you know, to that capacity. But over years and years, this Getz family just continued to aggressively collect fire artifacts and materials. And lo and behold, you know, step by step, we slowly become the world's largest. And it's, you know, the not only the United States and the FDNY pieces we have, but it's quite notable. I mean, we have, you know, antique hand pumpers from Japan. From we have a Meriwether that served in Lima, Peru. We have French pieces, English pieces. We have a 1901 pumper from Austria. Just an it's an amazing array of trucks. And when you come here, I think that's what fascinates people. First of all, they go, "Wow, where's all the Phoenix fire trucks?"
Right.
We only set in Phoenix. We do have a wagon and a fire engine from Phoenix, but there again, this isn't the Phoenix Fire Museum. This is a world fire museum. And it's, and so, you know, hence we're always going to be collecting pieces from wherever they come. Last week, we got a piece driven to us from Yakima, Washington. It was a 1929 Model T Chiefs truck from Yakima, and we'll be putting it on display shortly. But we have a piece from Nottinghamshire in England. That was had spent time at the Mattel toy factory, as you know, they emulated toys off of it after it served its time in England. So and that truck, by the way, is made entirely out of wood, covered in aluminum. But anyway, it's, I think that no one leaves here disappointed. I think we surprise even even the most unenthusiastic guests as they walk in and like, well, how many fire trucks can there actually be? And as they go from gallery to gallery and continue on, it's just, it knocks them off their feet. It's, you know, after 2 hours of walking and you still haven't seen it all, then you're pretty well left in awe. We have a wildland gallery, the only other wildland gallery to that form of firefighting happens to be up in Missoula, Montana. So we have a quite respectable wildland display and exhibit here. And then probably the most important mission I feel is we have some kid areas where we teach fire safety, which as we all know, because of COVID and other things that are going on in the schools, fire safety has really taken a back seat. So we're trying to move it and do it and offer parents an alternative if they really want their kids to understand fire safety. And we teach 14 safety rules and have a really nice education program for them. We're starting to see field trips again now with the kids and signing contracts with school districts. So I personally hope very much so, Danny, that you make your way out here. And like with all of our other guests, you will not be disappointed.
Yeah. Well, you'll have to let me know what you're interested in. So we'll have to have a sidebar at some point with my camera. I'll take some pictures or a video and you tell me if you want the NYFs or the coat or the helmet or the boots or whatever. Because, you know, it's in my basement right now and I have all this stuff from South America. And it's just like my basement's turned into a museum and I don't want it to be a museum. You know, I mean, I have medals and ribbons and all kinds of stuff from badges and hats and you name it. So
you're gonna have to come up with another name because Hall of Flame's taken. So you're gonna have to come up with basement of flame, I guess.
I'm looking to kind of downsize now. You know, I got my kids stuff here and I just want to start downsizing, you know. So you know, as you're speaking, you know, we talked about the turn of the century in the 1860s and how New York went from volunteer to paid. But, you know, when I came on the job, I started out in the South Bronx in 17 truck, you know, and there's such a history down there in the South Bronx in the, I guess we once called the 6th Division, right? Mm-hmm. And they called it the war years, right? So they, I don't know when they actually started. My father-in-law worked in 50 engine. There was two sections. So he was in the second section. He was a lieutenant. And then he was a captain 41 engine. And I came in to 17 truck. And I kind of caught the kind of tail end of those war years in 86. I guess they went on to about maybe around the 90s, something or other, you know. But there's such a rich history of firefighting that I don't, I wonder if the most of firefighters really know what went on back then. I would
say not. If they haven't really, like my main curator here, Mark Moorhead, likes to say, all of that information is deeply secretly hidden and where it'll never be found, and that's in books. So you really have to, you know, break open some of the, and believe me, there's some wonderful books out there on that subject. And I just think it's a matter of you know, today we, you know, our right now everything is about, you know, 30-second clips on Instagram and on TikTok and Twitter and stuff. So it's really hard to capture the attention required that would, you know, would require reading an entire chapter about, for instance, the war years or something. You have to really be a connoisseur of books to really dig that history up, because there's not a lot on it. I can tell you they just came out with a short movie for a film festival about the, you know, what Garrett Morgan did, but there's not been what should have been long ago, a Hollywood motion picture about his contributions to the fire service. And not only that, his contributions to his community by going down in the bid in the explosion that happened down underneath Lake Erie. He was 250 feet below the base of the lake when, you know, rescuing people. That in and of itself warrants a movie, the rescue that him and his brother pulled off. But there again, unless you really read about it, it was called the Bend Explosion. It stays a mystery. So I don't know how to do what you're saying, which is to get the young fire service interested in what occurred in yesteryear. You know, and when you say, you know, will that lead to things that will reoccur, because those situations are still out there, right? It's the, you know, the things to do with building collapse and, you know, specialty type work that never goes away. You know, it just, you know, one area draws our attention for a while. And while we're overlooking at that, you know, we just recently had here in Arizona an explosion involving lithium batteries that critically injured an entire company. All four guys were hospitalized and out of work for quite a period over a lithium battery explosion.
Yeah.
There again, and so you say, well, lithium batteries didn't occur back when you and I were young firefighters. It didn't matter. There was another item there that probably took the same precautions that maybe the lithium battery thing applies to. So it's, as they're learning the new stuff, sometimes going full circle back to the old stuff will actually provide some aspects. Have you been on that yet as a chief? Have you had some lithium battery?
Yep.
Not cars, but I'm talking about the lithium battery storage.
Yeah, the motorcycle. They're up in the hallways, and yeah, they just, when they charge, they just go off. And yeah, I had a few of them before, and not a heck of a lot, but I've had a few. Yeah,
we have these large charging stations that set out in remote areas in the desert and stuff, where there's, you know, like a small building filled with these that where the utility companies are charging those during the light time of emergent, or you know, when energy is cheaper, and then, you know, and then at nighttime they're collecting, and then in the daytime they're utilizing that. We, you know, with our extreme temperatures out here, we need boosts in electrification, and so these cabinets are everywhere, and they right. And they're fairly hazardous and to our industry. But anyway, that's, like you say, learn from your history, learn from what your forefathers experienced.
Now, you talk about a disaster, right? When I came on, I worked with guys, and they used to talk about the Jennings Street collapse. And okay. That was a collapse of a tenement, a five-story tenement. Guys almost drowned in the basement, right? Because it was a pancake collapse, right? It went from, you know, all the way down to the basement. And I think there were 20 some odd guys that were trapped, and they all could have been killed, you know, and you don't hear about this stuff. And these guys, they're amazing. I mean, and we just had our mass at 17 truck 16, 17 in June just passed. And I noticed that the old timers that I work with, they're starting to really become senile, you know, like they're really in the 80s and 90s now, you know?
Yes.
And the stories that are amazing. Like, I remember them telling me that, you know, like 17 had two sections, right? Then there was 60, then 41 engine had two sections plus a squad. And then 50 had two sections, 82 and 31 had all kinds of units in there, and 73 and 42 had a squad. So there was so many units, plus there was relocators that would come down. They told me that you could just stand on the rooftop of the firehouse and you would see the whole, just fires everywhere, you know, and the rigs would be lined up, you know, and these guys just did it like it was normal, you know?
Yeah.
Now, you know, like that seems like such a foreign concept, you know? I mean, even when I was a firefighter, you know, like I remember, you know, especially working in the squad, you know, we'd go to a few jobs at night, you know, but still when you think, well, the guys in the war years, they went through this, and well, then nothing's going on, you know? So like, everything's kind of relative in a sense, but I would love to see, I don't know, I just think that era in the FDNY in that area, I mean, there were other busy areas too. I mean, Bushwick and Bed-Stuy and parts of Brooklyn, Harlem was always busy. The Lower East Side of Manhattan was always busy. But that period of time between like the late 60s, 70s and up right through the 80s was like, I don't know, it was an era that was, I hope, you know, knock on wood, that, you know, we'll never see again. But the stuff that was just went on, it's just these guys never talked about it.
Exactly. That's exactly right. They didn't. It was just going to work, right? Just going to work. It's They were an interesting generation for sure. I stepped in, you know, I started in 1980, and you know, I was working with those, that same generation of guys that were, had started in the 60s and, you know, in the 50s after World War II. And yeah, it was a different time to become a firefighter and then become a recipient of the, of them as mentors, right? As the way that, the way they mentored you and the way that they kept you out of trouble and the way that they, at the same time would kind of quietly budge you and nudge you in different directions as they saw you trying to, you know, feel your way through all this. And me even more so as a, you know, on an engine truck, as a, you know, fighting lots of fires and going on lots of calls, but then also trying to mature myself as a paramedic, because back in those days, the paramedic program was, you know, was only about a decade old, and having, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of depth there. You know, basically paramedics started around the, you know, the early 70s, about 73, 74. And, you know, and if you were working in that capacity, you had a lot to learn. And, you know, it was a very specialized thing that you got the opportunity to go and become a paramedic, but then all of your other responsibilities were still in place. You still had to be, you know, a top firefighter and be able to do that. We didn't separate. Paramedics didn't go over to ambulances and stuff. They stayed on fire engines, at least out west here. It was a different model. And I was lucky enough to work at a firehouse that went on about 20 runs every 24 hours. And we got to exercise all those skills. And I think doing that frequently kept you good at what you did, both paramedic and firefighting. And I'll never forget some of the experiences that occurred during that time, and then having to even change gears in the middle of a call, you know, pull somebody out of a burning structure, and then next thing you do, you're trying to intubate that same person, but you're the person that pulled them out of there,
right?
And that's unthinkable in other systems, but that's what happened out here in Arizona back in the 80s, you know.
Well, Chuck, I know we could probably talk all day, but we're already been an hour, and I think that's usually about our limit, you know. So it's the Hall of Flame in Phoenix, Arizona. Are you looking for anything from besides just support, like people checking out your website, or you're looking for donations, or you're looking?
I think what I'm really hoping that most folks in New York, after they watch, you know, see our videos and watch the fly through of Rescue 4 and see the extent of what we've done, it'll become very evident to you that, you know, that we're a nonprofit, we're a 501c3. So we keep the lights on and the air conditioning on strictly by our small admission that we charge and our membership. So when I started here, we had about 150 members. I've managed to bring that up to about 1300. But if you go to our website, halloflame.org, you'll see a membership area. And if you sign on as a member, and obviously there's perks in that, you know, no admission price for you. You get a identification card. And then also, we'll send out twice a year, we send out a newsletter that's pretty extensive about what we're doing. But I think the best way that folks can support us is just signing on as a member and saying, I like what this place stands for and what it represents. And if you feel inclined to join us in that capacity, we'd love to have you as a member. And someday when you retire to Arizona, we'd love to have you as a volunteer.
maybe we'll see a FDNY war years section one of these days down in.
Don't be surprised. Don't be surprised. You'll be amazed how much I have an area in the Hall of Heroes to FDNY. We have Rescue 4 in a completely different gallery. We have Dr. Archer in our helmet area. There's a whole lot of FDNY here to see. So don't be a stranger. If you come to Arizona, please place us on the itinerary. We're literally, when you get off the plane, we're exactly a mile and a half from the airport. So you can Uber right to us and then make your plans from there. So.
Sounds good, Chuck. So I'll have to let Courtney know that you're on my show and that we're spreading the word.
Okay.
With that, I guess we're going to wrap it up. So.
Okay. You can get to all of our social medias, Danny, by at the top of our webpage. So if you want to go to Facebook, Instagram, because I can tell you, people like us so much, they kind of start, they think that by starting a a Facebook page for us separately helps us, but we try and filter everything back to our original.
Right.
So, give it a shot and see what you think. And if you like what you see that we did with Rescue Force, send us an email at info@halloflame.org. Thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks, Chuck. And I think we'll have a talk and, you know, you'll let me know what I could, you know, how I could get those NYFs or whatever you want. Let me know. I'll work it out. Okay. We'll figure it out. Until then, be safe and we'll see you on the radio.